Those of you who saw the picture, Valley of Decision, were probably impressed by the ugliness of the industrial architecture shown in that picture. It had drama, it had romance, it had power and throbbing life, but it depicted the haphazard attention which mills and factory buildings commonly received in the 1870s. No one thought of such workplaces as architecture at that time. Like Topsy, they just grew. In fact, it is only in our time that industrial architecture has been treated as architecture. Oh, to be sure, architects were sometimes called in as exterior decorators to hang some columns or buttresses on a core already designed. The thought was that such architectural millinery added the necessary aesthetic element to what was unavoidably a smoky, grimy, utilitarian shelter for the manufacture of certain products. In visiting such old factories, I have been amazed at the poor conditions of light and health in which industrial processes were, and sometimes still are, carried on. It's no wonder that accidents were frequent and plant morale low, and so much human energy had to be expended overcoming the handicaps of poor planning and poor light. Sometimes the engineers, to whom the design of these buildings was usually entrusted, rose above the general level and created a building which answered its purpose in a direct, clean-cut way. And I must say that it was the engineers who thought most and most clearly about the problem. But even in the products themselves, confusion of thought existed. Think back to the old cook stoves or the old furnaces or water heaters, with their skin-deep layer of decorative foliage, spaghetti some called it, which was presumed to make them beautiful. Compare those products with the products of today, and you will have some gauge of the change which has also occurred in industrial architecture. This change has come chiefly since World War I. It is due to no single factor, but we can point to the American system of mass production as having had a great influence in the revolution which ensued. Prior to 1910, manufacturing was usually carried on in buildings which were subdivided into 20-foot units, or bays as they are called. Products were manufactured in more or less fixed departments, and an inconvenient column needed for support was tolerated as inconvenient but necessary. Under the new system, however, the materials have to flow in a continuous process from one part of the building to another, raw materials entering at one point and the finished products leaving at another. Columns cannot be tolerated where they interfere with the proper operation of a machine or with the process. Furthermore, there must be provision for expansion, alteration, the addition of new equipment without interruption of the manufacturing process. Competition has forced manufacturers to improve the conditions for their workers. Studies have revealed that improper light, hazardous equipment, poor plant morale, inconveniently located entrances or exits or cafeterias or other facilities all lower productive efficiency and add to the cost of the finished article. As a result, manufacturing areas were enlarged, interfering columns eliminated, walls became walls of glass, and the possibility of alterations and additions was anticipated in the initial design in more recent plants. In place of 20-foot bays, 60-foot bays may be used. Today it is not uncommon to find manufacturing buildings with clear spans of 200 or 300 feet, spans as wide as many of our university buildings are long. Now, no one man has been responsible for this improvement. Credit must be given to a number, among them some Europeans who are now working in the United States, and to that redoubtable pioneer, Frank Lloyd Wright. But in volume and in sustained high level of accomplishment, as well as in the introduction of new ideas, a large share of the credit must go to the late Albert Kahn of Detroit. In the year 1938, his organization was responsible for 19% of all architect-designed United States industrial building. 10 years earlier, he received one of the most extraordinary commissions ever awarded to any architect. To his office in Detroit came a group of engineers from the USSR with an order for a $40 million tractor plant and an outline for a total building program amounting to $2 billion. To perform this task, Kahn's Detroit office designed a dozen factories, and the rest were handled in a special office set up in Moscow, employing 1,500 draftsmen. George Nelson describes the circumstances in his book, The Industrial Architecture of Albert Kahn Incorporated. I quote from this: "Probably no organization has ever had a more severe test of its flexibility, speed, and competence. Not only did the plants have to be designed, but machinery had to be selected and ordered, process layouts had to be prepared, and the very tools needed to build the plants had to be ordered here and shipped over. The office in Moscow consisted of a large percentage of Soviet draftsmen who had apparently never seen a pencil before, and the Khan representatives not only had to run it by day, but hold classes by night. Factories such as the great Stalingrad tractor plant or the Nizhny Tahil freight car factory were erected in deserts of virgin forests, and the labor was chiefly raw peasants who were unfamiliar with any machine more complicated than a shovel. For almost 3 years, the Khan technicians labored with their untrained human material, an impossibly overloaded transportation system, and inaccessible building sites. Hundreds of plants were designed and equipped. End of quotation. But what of the man who accomplished this task and many others of almost equal difficulty? Born in Germany and a Jew, one shudders to think of what might have happened to him had he chosen to remain in that country. But in 1880, at the age of 11, he came with his mother, aunt, and five other children to join his father in Baltimore. Within a year, the family moved to Detroit. There, Albert began his architectural career by attending evening classes in Julius Melcher's Art School. Soon he became a draftsman in the office of George D. Mason upon Melcher's recommendation. Mr. Mason says that he never knew anyone with such an enormous capacity for concentration and such application to study as Albert Kahn. In a few years, a scholarship carried Albert to Europe, with the requirement that he write 12 articles and make 12 sketches on the trip. The sketches gave him little trouble, but the articles much. Apparently, they weren't very good either. For after the editor of the magazine which had contributed the scholarship received the second article, the editor wrote to Albert, "Never mind the articles, send more sketches." Back in Detroit, Kahn embarked on independent practice. One of his early commissions was that of remodeling a house for Mr. Henry Joy, then president of the Packard Motor Company. Shortly after, Mr. Joy came to Kahn's office and wanted him to design a factory for the Packard Company. Kahn said he'd try, although he'd never designed a factory before. He was 34 years old at the time. After that first factory, commissions multiplied to an almost astronomical number. He continued as Packard's architect for almost 40 years, and as architect for the Ford Company for almost that long. For General Motors, he built about 127 important structures. Other firms representing food, textiles, clothing, cosmetics, and business machines employed him. His organization, which expanded to a force of about 500, became known as outstanding for their hospital design. But it also built schools, banks, clubs, hotels, theaters, and office buildings, along with a tremendous volume of industrial work which constantly flowed into the office. In explaining his success, Kahn said that he always listened to what people said they needed and then gave it to them. Such a statement is oversimplification, of course. Again and again, Kahn made suggestions which gave the clients more than they said they needed, and frequently he was able to save them money. Take the case of the hot and cold strip mills of the Republic Steel Corporation in Cleveland, Ohio. Until Kahn received the commission for these mills, steel companies had always had their own engineers design the new steel plants. Steelmaking is so specialized and complex that they didn't think an architect could plan an efficient steel factory. Even for this particular mill, Republic engineers had prepared drawings before the project was handed to the Kahn organization. 11 days after the Kahn organization started work on this job, drawings were ready for a beginning on construction, and the amount of structural steel called for in these Kahn-prepared drawings was 2,100 tons less than that called for in the design made by the company engineers. In the manufacturing plant for the Lady Esther Company at Clearing, Illinois, the problem was to design the necessary manufacturing space and yet permit a gravity flow of materials in the manufacturing process. At first, a multi-story building seemed necessary, and this was the sort of factory the company had been using. But after several tentative plans, a single-story structure was adopted using an overhead conveyor system for the transfer of materials, with balconies in some parts of the building to permit use of the gravity flow. The manufacturing process for each product moves in a straight line with no cross-circulation or retracing. Raw materials are delivered and stacked at one end, right behind the production line for each product, rouge, lipstick, face powder, whatever it is. After moving down the production line, the finished products are stacked at the other end in sealed cartons ready for shipping. If new products are undertaken, Other production lines can be added on to the east side without any interruption of the existing production lines. And although the factory is 200 feet wide and a block long, every part of it is flooded with daylight by means of overhead windows, monitor windows, and continuous glass walls extending from floor to ceiling. The exterior is a very direct expression of the interior, with a powerful horizontality interrupted only by the carefully proportioned entrance lobby. All employees enter through this lobby, thereby avoiding any differentiation between workers. Throughout the plant, the comfort and convenience of the workers have received detailed attention. An amazing display of Kahn's speed and efficiency was given in the expansion of the Martin Bomber factory. One day in 1937, Kahn received a phone call from Glenn Martin saying that Martin wanted to double his plant capacity. The project was to total about $2 million and in size equal to several football fields. Could Mr. Kahn do this in 11 or 12 weeks? Mr. Kahn thought he could. And within 48 hours after that phone call, the first contracts were being let. 11 weeks later, the factory was in production. Such results were possible only because of the remarkable organization which Kahn had built up through the years, with highly trained departments to handle every phase of the work. The creation of such a large and complex organization is in itself a tribute to Mr. Kahn's ability, but it doesn't explain the man. There was in him the power of logical analysis and indefatigable industry, and a keen aesthetic sense. These qualities are reflected in his buildings. It was fortunate, of course, that Albert Kahn came into full power at the time the automotive industry was developing, but perhaps as fortunate for the industry as for Albert Kahn. No one can visit the tremendous River Rouge plant of the Ford Motor Company without thrilling to the drama of American mass production. That this drama was given appropriate form is largely due to the genius of Albert Kahn. This plant and 1,000 others the world over will stand as his memorials.